Philosopher Cornel West is one of the most visible public intellectuals in the U.S. Tavis Smiley is, after Oprah, the best-known black media figure in the country. They co-host a weekly public radio talk show in which they frequently take on the mainstream media and the political establishment, both of which they blame for ignoring the disenfranchisement of the working poor. Steve Paulson talks with them about the state of American democracy.
Let me just start with a very basic question, and I'll just throw it to either one of you, whoever wants to pick this up first. Are African Americans still disenfranchised?
Well, I think it depends on what you mean by disenfranchised. Look at the legal level. You've got a disproportionate number of felons owing to a racist criminal justice system who are unable to vote, unable to gain access to jobs with a living wage. When you talk about right to housing, still right to health care, even given the new health care bill under the Obama administration, there's certain fundamental rights stipulated by the UN Declaration of Rights that many Americans don't have, not just black people. And so it depends on what you mean by disenfranchised.
Mm-hmm. Tavis?
African Americans, even with a black man in the White House as president, African Americans still lag far behind in every single leading economic indicator category. There's not a single economic indicator category where African Americans do not lag far behind. And some weeks ago when that Pew research study came out, Steve, that talked about the loss of black wealth, that talked about the gap between the have-gots and the have-nots in black and white terms, it underscores yet again that not only are we disenfranchised, to your question, we are more disenfranchised now than we've been in a long time. Life for African Americans in this country right now is at depression era levels. We've been hearing this phrase, you know, this is the worst recession since the Great Depression. We've heard that across the board, the worst recession since the Great Depression. Well, for black folk, we are now at depression era levels. And the real danger is that when Obama was ushered into the White House, this conversation began amongst our colleague, Steve, that we are now living in a post-racial America.
Right.
Dr. West, I've pushed back on that consistently. America may be, indeed is, less racist to have elected Obama as president. Less racist, but not post-racial.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask about him. You've both mentioned Barack Obama here. We've got a black president. It would seem to be the epitome of the enfranchisement of African Americans.
Oh, at the legal level, there's no doubt that the election of a brilliant and charismatic president, Barack Obama, was a major breakthrough given the history of slavery and Jim Crow. The problem is he's neoconservative abroad, neoliberal at home, and therefore he's still very much a part of the structural constraints of a system that is fundamentally tilted against poor and working people. So that, again, at the legal level, he represents unprecedented achievement. That's a beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. That's symbolic. It results from tremendous struggle, blacks, white, red, yellow, and others. But when you look at right to jobs with a living wage, right to quality housing, right to health care, right to safety in a community without bullets flowing, you still see a disproportionate number of black folk.
And how much of that responsibility goes to the president, in this case, to Barack Obama? I mean, can you hold him accountable for this? I mean, you know, it's a huge bureaucracy that he's in charge of, huge political problems.
My dear brother, Tavis Smiley, who I'm always so blessed to work with after 20-something years, he wrote a book called Accountable. So I think he's got a lot to say about the accountability of the president.
I think every president has to be held accountable. When Barack Obama, President Obama, says to black America, as he has said many times when asked specifically why he won't address head-on problems that plague the black community, he has said consistently, I'm the president of all of America, as if black folks somehow aren't Americans too. Black folk need to have their issues addressed and in some cases redressed, not because they're black, but because they're catching the most hell, because they're the ones most in pain, because they're the ones who are having lives that are becoming less and less democratized on a regular basis. So that if you were in a car accident, Steve, and they rushed you to the hospital with the head trauma, I would hope they would not start operating on your left foot. you respond to where the pain is most acute. And so in that regard, black folk and brown folk, for that matter, and Native American brothers and sisters are not asking for respect and not asking for resources because they're black, you know, red, yellow, or brown, but because that is where the pain is most acute. Again, back to that Pew study of weeks ago about where this country is feeling the pain the most. And so every president has to be held accountable. But I believe that we have to understand that accountability is a beautiful thing. If you ever find yourself in a relationship, personally or professionally, and your partner does not want to be held accountable, get out as quickly as you can. Accountability is a good thing in relationships, indeed for politicians. The bottom line is this, that Dr. West and I have said consistently were, and this is a Westian formulation, I can't take credit for this because he's in the room. Were he not, Steve, I would tell you this is a Tavis original. I'd be lying. But since he's here, I can't take credit for this. But this is a Westian formulation where Obama is concerned. We must respect the president. We must protect the president. We must also correct the president. We always respect the president. And when he needs to be protected against vicious, vulgar, vitriolic, racist, white supremacist, Tea Party, Donald Trump attacks, we will protect the president. He must always be respected, protected, but also corrected. This president is not Jesus. He doesn't walk on water. He makes mistakes. In many ways, he's afraid to address African-American issues, to your point, directly, because he's afraid of being accused of being tribal. And so he gives a standard response that I'm the president of all of America, and never gets around to really addressing the problems that are acutely impacting African-Americans. Although, when gays and lesbians jump up and down about don't ask, don't tell, and he should have done it sooner than he did, I'm glad he finally did it, but he responds to that particular constituency.
And you're saying he very rarely speaks specifically to African Americans.
Not rarely, never. it's not a question of rare, it's a question of never.
So you have a real problem with this, I'm the president of all America. I mean, he is, obviously.
He
but
is.
You're saying that he needs to do more than that. I mean, he needs to address specifically
but
concerns
any
of
president who says he's the president of all America means on the ground that he responds to those who have most money, most resources, and most pressure. So when he goes to the business roundtable and says, I am the president of all America, they know exactly what he's talking about. Namely, he's going to speak to their interests before he speaks to poor people's interests because they have money, resources, and influence. And everybody knows that. So let's just get beyond the rhetoric in terms of this generic formulation of I am president of everyone. The thing I think that's most upsetting about Barack Obama, and here I think it's a philosophical point about democracy, that we know that the great contributions of the United States to world civilization have to do with the various ways in which we affirm the dignity of everyday people. It could be Emerson, it could be Whitman, it could be Murray Rukeyser, it could be Louis Armstrong, it could be Duke Ellington, it could be Gershwin, it could be Sondheim, it could be Frank Lloyd Wright. All of these had democratic sensibilities having to do with finding the genius in everyday people, the extraordinary and ordinary people. Well, black people have a tradition from Frederick Douglass to Martin King of a reconstruction of democracy. It's a matter of what does democracy look like in the tradition of black people struggling against slavery, against Jim Crow, and now against Jim Crow Jr. And when you look at that tradition, King is probably the major figure. Mm-hmm. And Barack Obama mobilized King's legacy and then channeled it in neoliberal, centrist, democratic leadership council-like ways. And that, for me, is a form of political blasphemy. Hmm. Blasphemy.
Well, let me move the discussion away from President Obama and ask a more general question about leadership. How much do intellectuals matter in the struggle for democracy?
Intellectuals always matter because ideas matter. I mean, part of what we're dealing with now is the triumph of right-wing ideas put forward by intellectuals, generated by think tanks, and now gaining access in the last 30 years to universities, shaping the very narrow corporate media with truncated options and limited alternatives made available to the American people, and greed is good.
So you're saying sort of the conservative movement, the conservative revolution, it was founded by conservative intellectuals.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, all the discussions we had, William Buckley and the others pushing the free markets, unregulated markets, and unfettered markets. Well, you know, they won. They convinced Larry Summers. They convinced Bill Clinton. They convinced Robert Rubin, as well as the disciples of Milton Friedman. And for a while, right, most of the economists said, what? We're all Milton Friedmanians. Well, that's an intellectual battle. Now, after 2008, when the greed is good model was shattered, right, it became clear they didn't really know what they're talking about. Oh, my God, they can't even run the system. These markets aren't self-sufficient at all. It generates fraud, indecent action, illegal action, criminal action, and so forth. And so that the battle over ideas is always very, very important.
So I guess the question is why? I mean, why did the conservative intellectuals win, or at least gain the ascendancy right now? I mean, what about the intellectuals on the left?
Well, I mean, one, the liberals had marginalized the left in the 70s, and the liberal model itself began to be not just interrogated and called into question, but was unable to deliver. And the American people are in this yin-yang. If you don't go for the Democrats, then you got to go for the Republicans. So the choice is between, well, milquetoast liberalism is not working, and this mean-spirited Republicanism got a lot of energy and conviction, and let's try it out. More and more people opted for the right-wing version. Now that's being contested. This is what we mean by decline. You know, what we witnessed in 2011 is the exhaustion, the relative exhaustion of milquetoast liberalism, mean-spirited conservatism. Where do we go? That's a deep question. That's very much what Davis and I are wrestling with in terms of the legacy of Martin King.
Yeah. And I think Steve, to build on Doc's point, if anybody can ever build on a brilliant point made by Dr. West, the democracy is in trouble so long as we think that we can live in a country where 1% of the people own and control more wealth than 90% of the people. My read of history, and I'm so glad you're doing this wonderful series on democracy, because my read of history suggests to me that there is no empire, back to Doc's framework about empire, there is no empire in the history of the world that at some point did not falter or fail. Every empire at some point fails. And I don't know if it is our arrogance, our hubris, our patriotism that has now morphed into nationalism. I don't know what it is that doesn't allow us to even consider that, like every other empire, at some point we could fail as well. This could be the beginning of the end. Now, as you well know, to say that, and I'm sure you'll get mail about this when this airs, to say that gets one labeled anti-American. So you got to be careful when, where, and how you say that, even on public radio. But at the end of the day, every empire has eventually failed. And I believe that this country one day is going to implode, or put another way, get crushed under the weight of its own poverty. If we don't figure out a way to eradicate poverty, poverty, I believe, one day is ultimately going to eradicate us.
Explain what you mean. Well, how would poverty eradicate us?
Poverty will eradicate us in that you can't have this gap continue to grow between the have-gots and the have-nots. It can't happen. Dr. West mentioned earlier, at the end of Dr. King's life, King was trying to raise this very point. There is no no empire, no country in the world. What we just saw recently in Egypt and in Tunisia and still now ongoing in Libya, when you see these uprisings around the world, it happens because the poor at some point get restless. Those who are economically and politically and socially and culturally disenfranchised eventually get to a point, as I like to say, where they become like Popeye, the cartoon character. I done stoods all I can stands, and I can't stands no more. And then with Popeye, out comes the can of spinach. Well, the proverbial or the metaphorical can of spinach are the protest. People take, and y'all know something about that here in Wisconsin. You know something about that. But at some point, people get restless. People get tired. It was Fannie Lou Hamer who said, "I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired." At some point, people start to feel that. And that's when that energy gets channeled into a certain way. And if you don't address poverty, you don't talk about eradicating poverty, poverty may end up eradicating your empire, because at some point, it bubbles up to a point where people can't take it anymore, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. We're running short of time here. A wrap-up question. You said earlier, the question that you two talk about, okay, what's to be done? Huge question, obviously, but for starters, where do you go?
Well, one is you've got to be like the Sankofa bird and look back at and be in contact with the best of the past in order to move forward. That's why the Whitmans and the Emersons, and that's why the Martin Kings and Fannie Lou Hamers, and that's why the Sondheims make a difference. We're talking about art, we're talking about politics. Young people need to be informed by and inspired by the best of the tradition that those who came before. And what did they do? They thought boldly. What did they do? They acted courageously and compassionately. And what did they do? They were willing to live and die for something bigger than themselves. Those are all three preconditions for any revitalization of any democracy. And if you don't have either one of them, you're going to lose your democracy and you end up with a crypto-fascist regime. And those folk who struggled in the past, they cry from their graves.
My answer simply and quickly is, and I know this may be a pipe dream, Steve, but we have to have more people who are willing to tell the truth. It's that simple for me. People who are willing to tell the truth, put another way, people who are willing, I don't mean just now media people, I mean Americans of every race, color, creed, of every political ideology, of every faith tradition. We have to have more Americans who are willing to tell the truth about the suffering of everyday people. More Americans who are willing to accept the responsibility to simply say what they see. It is impossible to look around these days in this country and to not see the fragility of our democracy. And if we just find the courage, the conviction, the commitment, the character to just tell the truth about what we see, to just say what it is that we see, that at least gets the conversation going. And I trust the American people enough, and I believe in the American people enough, that if the facts are put on the table, if someone commits himself or herself or a network or a newspaper, not to covering the horse race, not to casting the story or framing it in terms of winners and losers, but to simply tell the truth. Tell the American people the truth, and we can figure this out. But this game of winning versus losing, that's what's going to kill us.
Cornel West and Tavis Smiley are the hosts of Public Radio's weekly talk program, Smiley and West. Steve Paulson spoke with them.
Priority.
Most Deaf from Raise Hope for Congo.
Top priority, peace before everything, God before anything, love before anything, real before everything, home before any place, shoot before anything, style and stay, radiate, love, power, slay the hate, truth killer, fakey face, bayer say it to they face, ain't afraid of major straight, grace set the table straight, flow greatest like the greatest lakes. Gates on great estates, quiet water, major waves. Steer the course, make a way, and come ashore on a greater day. Homegrown from the greatest grain, full flavor in the native strain. Now put that on your brainy brain. Full exposure to faith and slang, minimum wage and major gangs. Y'all seen Dante the Bay, day to night and day to day. They came to play, we came to stay. Get out the way. Biatch, Sunspot, Heat Rocks, Brooklyn Finest Preservation, the B-Box. Friend of Folk, Poison of Detox. When we rock, the people are respond. Priority. Peace before anything, God before everything, love before anything, real before everything, home before any place, shoot before anything, style and stay, radiate, love, power, slay the hate, priority.